Good morning. If you have your Bibles with you, I'd ask you to turn them to 2 Kings chapter 6. 2 Kings chapter 6. That's where I'd like to study with you this morning. While you're turning there, allow me to express my appreciation for the invitation. Don has actually asked several times over the last few years if I would speak. And generally, when I'm moving my kids in, we get them in the room. And then I go almost straight to the airport and get out of town as fast as I can before they try to come back home. And so this year is our last time to move a kid into FC. My youngest daughter, Emily, is here. And so I told Don, okay, I'll hang around this time. And so I'm very grateful for the invitation. I know it's an exciting weekend for not only the folks that are here visiting, moving your children in to Florida College, but for this congregation. I'm sure the influx of all these godly kids, but hopefully they're all godly, is an encouragement to this group. I know Don has mentioned several times through the years how much they enjoy, how much this church enjoys the college kids. And as a parent whose kids are down here, let me tell you, those of you who are a part of this congregation all the time, how meaningful it is for a parent to know that there's a group of Christians in the area, and there's a bunch in Tampa, I recognize that, but a group of Christians in the area that care about your kids, that are looking out for them. Those of you who live in this area, you know, unless your kids have gone off, you don't appreciate how significant that is. And so thank you on behalf, I'm sure, of a lot of parents that are here this morning for all the kindness that you show to all these kids that are down here in school. So let's give some attention now, if you would, to our study together. I want to begin, before we actually read this little story in 2 Kings, by offering a little bit of a historical perspective from my life. I played football when I was younger, like many people did. And the only time in my life I can really remember feeling a physical sense of panic, other than right before I said I do to my wife. The only other time I can really remember the physically, not emotionally, not mentally, not being nervous. I'm talking about a physical sense of panic. Was playing football, strangely enough. We had a coach named Dean Elliott, and Coach Elliott was a bit of a sadist, I guess. He used to have a drill that he made us do called Rabbit, and he would put generally the big slow guys, and I was one of the slow guys, about 15, 20 yards out in front of everybody else, and then line the rest of the football team up behind them. And you had the rest of the football field. If you could get to the goal line before they got to you, they couldn't touch you. But if they got to you before you got across the field, it was pretty much anything goes. And after about 20 yards, I knew I was toast. I could hear them behind me hollering and screaming and laughing and blood-curdling yells. And I made it about 40 yards before the first guy hit me. And then they just dogpiled. To this day, I have no idea what the point of that drill was. But it is the one time I remember as a young person feeling absolutely overwhelmed. There was a force behind me that I could not get away from that was going to impact me, and it was going to hurt, and I couldn't do anything at all about it. But let me ask you something about the world we're living in. I assume probably most everybody here this morning are Christians. Do you feel a little bit overwhelmed about what's going on in our culture, in our nation, in our world? And it may be any number of things that impact you. It may be the mass killings that we're seeing. It may be the political tension that we're seeing in our country. It may be I almost hesitate to say it this way, but this is the way I feel in my life, almost a resurrection of racial tension that seemed to have kind of gotten better for a while, and now all of a sudden, just any nationality, it's not about color or creed, it's just anybody that's different, there is this tension about those that are different from us, and then the moral, the absolute deplorable moral circumstance that we find ourselves in. And You know, I've got three girls, and we're trying to raise them and send them out into the world, you know, arrows from our quiver that we're shooting. And I must be honest with you, I'm scared to death. That there is almost a sense of physical overwhelm that I feel. Like over my shoulder, God's people are in trouble. Now, I ask you, by nod of head, do you ever sense that in your life as a Christian? 3, 4, 5 people. It's okay to nod. This is Bible class, okay? You know, God repeatedly tells His people, Old Testament, New Testament, whether you want to talk about the apostles in Matthew 10, where He's kind of training them for not only the limited commission, but the great commission, or whether you want to talk about the Sermon on the Mount, especially Luke's account, where He says, don't be afraid, tells the apostles, don't be afraid of what they can do to you. Paul tells Timothy, God didn't give us a spirit of fear. The Hebrew writers telling the Hebrews, fear not, God's with you, God's not going to forsake you. Over and over and over, it seems to me, God's trying to tell His people, don't be afraid. When Moses takes the children of Israel right up to the promised land, one of the themes in the early chapters of Deuteronomy is God keeps saying, don't be afraid of them. If you're going to be afraid of anybody, be afraid of me. Don't be afraid of them. And the fact that God's telling us that all the time seems to me to be a reminder that one of the issues that we have as God's people, especially in a culture that's becoming increasingly wicked, is that we tend to be afraid. In 2 Kings chapter 6, beginning in verse 8, this is kind of the end of a section, and we'll touch on the section here in just a moment. There is a story that is told us about Elisha. You'll be familiar with it when we start reading it, if it doesn't already ring a bell. It is, I guess, probably my favorite Old Testament story. And I think it is especially appropriate for Christians in the day in which we live, because there is a sense of overwhelming dread about what's happening in our country and what's happening in our world and what's going to happen with our kids. I don't worry about me so much, but kids, grandkids, what's going to happen? What kind of world are they going to face? Are they going to be persecuted? Are they going to be ostracized? Is Christianity going to continue to decrease and the wickedness around us increase? And what's going to happen? 2 Kings chapter 6 and verse 8. Now the king of Syria was making war against Israel. He consulted with his servant, saying, my camp will be in such and such a place. And the man of God sent to the king of Israel, saying, beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are coming down there. Then the king of Israel sent someone to the place of which the man of God had told him. Thus he warned him, and he was watchful there, not just once or twice. Therefore the heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled by this thing. He called his servants and said to them, will you not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? And one of his servants said, none, my lord. But Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. So he said, go see where he is, that I may send and get him. And it was told him, saying, surely he is in Dothan. Therefore he sent horses and chariots and a great army there. And they came by night and surrounded the city. And when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? So he answered, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. So Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So when the Syrians came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, strike this people, I pray, with blindness. And he struck them with blindness, according to the word of Elisha. And Elisha said to them, this is not the way, nor is this the city. Follow me, I will bring you to the man whom you seek. But he led them to Samaria. So it was when they had come to Samaria that Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. And the Lord opened their eyes and they saw, and there they were inside Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, my father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? And he answered and said, you shall not kill them. Would you kill those whom you have taken captive with your sword and your bow? Set food and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master. Then he prepared a great feast for them, and after they had ate and drank, he sent them away, and they went to their master. So the bands of Syrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel. Well, I want to make three observations from this passage that I think are helpful. At least they're helpful to me. I hope they'll be helpful to you. As we look at the world around us and try to adapt to living in a world where Christianity, in its broadest sense, is no longer the majority, and I think we're moving in that direction rapidly. The first observation I would make from this passage, and really from the whole section, is that we need to understand how God uses His people. This is kind of the end. Actually, there's a couple of more chapters that tell us about the life of Elijah and Elisha, and I think it's pertinent to put this story in the bigger context. If you go all the way back into 1 Kings, all the way back to chapter 16 or so, we are introduced to an era in the northern kingdom, and any of you that are college students that are in here, you should know all this from your freshman history and geography class. If you don't, you get an F for worship this morning, okay? This is the age wherein a man named Omri becomes king in Israel, and Omri has a dynasty. There are four generations of the descendants of Omri, and not only in the northern kingdom, but his descendants intermarry into the southern kingdom. And Omri was a very successful king. In fact, historians tell us that during the reign of Omri and Ahab, the first of the dynasty behind him, that the military and particularly the economic status of the northern kingdom perhaps even approached that of Solomon, which is almost unbelievable to me. And yet at the same time, they were a very prosperous nation at that time. They were fairly successful militarily. They had pretty good relations with some of the major powers that are growing in the world around. Those who were threats to them, they defeated repeatedly. In fact, if you read through this section, you'll notice that there's an ongoing war of sorts with Syria, which is the enemy in the story that we're reading. And God is constantly delivering them from the attacks of Syria, the attacks of Ethiopia. It's a kind of a fascinating section. But Omri's son marries Jezebel, who most of us are familiar with, who was the daughter of the king of Sidon and also a Baal worshiper, and she involves Ahab in Baal worship and basically turns the entire nation away from God. They were already moving that way, but they just, on a huge scale, deserted God. And in response, what God does is He sends Elijah and Elisha. Essentially, God's response to an entire nation falling into spiritual decay is two men. Now, they're not the only people who are faithful to God, and yet those two men are to serve for all of the years of their work, which spans most of these kings from Ahab all the way through Jehoram. Their job is to remind people, that God's in control, to remind people that God's still active in the affairs of the world, because I guarantee you, 1 Kings chapter 19 tells us that there's only 7,000 people who hadn't bowed the knee to Baal. I guarantee you, from the perspective of Elijah and Elisha and those 7,000 people, God's cause is lost. And all of the ungodliness and immorality that we see around us, what was happening around them. And they're trying to raise their kids, and they're trying to do their job, and they're trying to keep the law, and they're trying to be honest, and they're trying to be faithful in a land where it was very hard for them to hide. They had to dress different, they had to talk different, they had to eat different, they had to act different. Don't you know they felt overwhelmed? And what was God's response? Well, when I read this section, I'm very much moved by all the miracles that are there. You go all the way back. In fact, if you've got your bookmark in 2 Kings 6, you can go back to chapter 17, and you have the drought that Elijah prayed for. And then you get to chapter 18, and you have Elijah and the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, and God sends the fire down and burns up the sacrifice and burns up the water and burns up the altar, and all the people stand back, oh, Yahweh is God. And yet they just turn right around. And throughout the lives of Elijah and Elisha, you have miracle after miracle after miracle after miracle. And I think our tendency is, maybe if God just do a few miracles. And that's the way I look at this. I think God's watching what's happening in our world. And I'm sure God, if he decided to take a hand and make an impact on folks, he could take a hand and make an impact on folks. He could remind us that he's still in control in some grandiose way. And actually, he does that. But do you know what the impact of most of these miracles are? In spite of the fact that the people in chapter 18 go, oh, Yahweh is God, it doesn't really change anything. You know what changed things? People who were influenced personally by Elijah and Elisha. There's a school of prophets that appears to begin and grow during this time. There are stories throughout this section, these 15 or 20 chapters, where here's a widow woman over here. Here's a woman over here who her and her husband are taking care of one of the prophets. And here's Naaman, the Syrian captain who's struck with leprosy. And throughout this, you have all these little stories about God helping people that are in need. And in the meantime, he's sending Elijah and he's sending Elisha. And they're going and they're talking to the kings. They're not just sharing their influence with a small circle. They're involved in what's happening in the nations. And all of this is intended to remind us. God's still powerful. God's still in control. God still sets kings up and brings kings down. God's still involved. God's still taking care of his people. God's still helping those that are in need. God hasn't changed. And I tell you, from my perspective, that's something that I need to be reminded of from time to time. I was on my way over here this morning, and I'm driving. I'm staying out in Plant City with my brother-in-law. And I'm driving down the road, and some guy comes up. I'm in Emily's car. Driving, gets right on my bumper, swings around, flies on by. Which he just might as well have cursed me. And I hope you get a ticket. And that was the mildest thing I could come up with at the time. And I tell you, I look at the world and I see selfishness, disregard, sexual immorality and perversion that is now flying your face. If you don't like it, that's fine. You're going to have to deal with it because we're here to stay. And I see all these attitudes around, and it's discouraging. Elijah felt some of that too. Jezebel threatens to kill him. He runs off to Beersheba. Is ready just to die. God feeds him, and so he goes on down, ends up at Sinai. God takes care of him. God gives him that little lesson. God's not in the wind. God's not in the fire. God's not in the earthquake. That's not the way God works, and yet that's what I'd like to see. Hey, how about a little fire on that guy right there? How about an earthquake? If you're from California, I'm sorry for what I'm about to say. If that just fall off an earthquake in the ocean, everybody else in the country already believes this. If you're from California, sorry. That's what we all think. If California just fall off in the ocean, we'd all be better. And you know, we love for God to intervene in what's going on around us. And the reality is, the way that God deals with evil now is the way that God has always dealt with evil. It's not going to be some miracle that's going to stop everything all of a sudden. Even though from time to time he reminds us he's in control, those miracles are for us to use now. God did that then. He could do that now. But the big point is, he uses folks like me and you to make a difference in an ungodly world. And for the kids that are here, you get to a certain age when you're an adult and you just, you know, you kind of quit caring what everybody around you thinks. I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to do my job. If you don't like me for that, that's okay. I'm not going to die. I think you're more susceptible when you're a young person or when your kids are little and you're starting to raise your kid and you're more concerned about what's going on around you. And I must tell you that the reality is, we have to be engaged. We can't pull away from the world. We can't run and hide in the caves and in the hills like the Israelites did so very often. Our job is to stand up, not be discouraged, remember that God is still in control, and to go out and be the people who do what is good. The people who, every time we have an opportunity, Galatians chapter 6, do good to all men. And especially to those who are of the household of faith. Now is when we lean on each other. Now is when we find our strength in each other so we can go out and really be salt and light. You know, if you're my age, I'm starting to push 60. It's hard to think that, but and some of you pushed that over a long time ago. You know, we grew up in an age where Christianity, the big concept, was the norm in this country. But I'm not sure that it is anymore, especially in the younger generations that are coming along. It's an ungodly world, or it's an uncertain world. The post-modern age has pretty much changed the culture around us. And you younger folks that are growing up, you need to remember, God did all this stuff, so we will know now that He's still in charge and I have a job to do. In Ezekiel chapter 3, Ezekiel was faced with a very similar circumstance with the children of Israel who are off in captivity and facing a lot of doubt and uncertainty about whether or not God really cares about them or whether God's really powerful. And Ezekiel's doing a bunch of crazy stuff. God had Ezekiel do some weird things, don't you know? He was kind of viewed as the town weirdo. And yet, he got people's attention. God had him do things, but the power wasn't in the weird things he was doing. The power was in the word that he was delivering. And that's still where the power is. It's our job to stand up and say, you know, this is what God says. Yeah, but, you know, I could lose my job if I speak out against homosexuality. Well, this is what God says. God says homosexuality is a sin. Does that make me a homophobe? I'm scared of people that are engaged? No. Does that mean I hate them? No. Well, I mean, we can stand up and stand for what's right and speak out so that, as God tells Ezekiel, they'll know that a prophet's been among them. Who knows how many people we can touch by simply saying, this is what God says. And I care about you and I love you and I want, but I'm not going to kowtow. I'm not going to be afraid because God's still in control. And as you go through the Bible, that's the way God's always addressed evil. You know, the Roman Empire was an ungodly era in history. And Jesus sent 12 men out and they turned the world upside down. So let me suggest to you that we need to remember that God expects us to go out, do our work, be an influence for good, stand up, stand out, plant the seed, and let God take care of the rest of it. Second observation, and I know if you look at your watch now, you always look at your watch after the between points to try to figure out, okay? I know where we are, so just relax. Second observation is this. Go back to 2 Kings 6, and this is my favorite part of the story. I guess it's everybody's favorite part of the story. Remember that we can go do what I just talked about, that like Noah and Moses and all these other people that were called upon to stand up in times of wickedness. We can stand up in times of wickedness without fear because God is loyal to His people. You read this story, and actually even the bigger story emphasizes God's faithfulness to His people. Even the northern kingdom, which from the time Jeroboam set up the golden calf, started moving away from God. God still took care of them. God was patient with them. God kept His end of the covenant for 200 years. 200 years. When they're worshiping Baal and they're involved in all kinds of ungodliness and they're sacrificing their children. And yet God at times actually blessed them. In Jeroboam II's reign, there is a statement made. It's over in 2 Kings, a few more chapters down, that God had said, I'm not going to extinguish them. And God had compassion on His people, just like all these stories that we read in this section. God's caring for His people, and He's faithful to His people, and He's taking care of His people. And all those are intended to remind us of this very crucial fact. God may not deliver us from every evil thing that comes along, but God has offered the ultimate deliverance from evil. And it's our job to help people see that there is a greater power that God has offered to us and to you, and it is the power of redemption and salvation and resurrection and eternal life and eternal association. And folks, if we're not making the contact and the connection for people around us that God of the Bible is not just someone who did miracles, He did all that to prove He can save you and forgive you, then we've just completely missed the point. We're living for the spiritual. And the interesting thing about this is it's the spiritual that God emphasizes. King of Syria is going to ambush the king of Israel. And Elisha is sending word to the king of Israel. Hey, don't go camping over there. Don't go hunting over there. Don't travel by this route because the king of Syria has got an ambush set up for you. And this happens over and over, not once or twice, we are told. And finally, the king of Syria is frustrated. Okay, I'm going to find the spy among us. And one of his guys, it's interesting to me that one of the Syrians knows this. Hey, nobody's against you, king. They've got Elisha. Elisha's reputation, just one guy doing what he was supposed to do, had extended far beyond the boundaries of Israel, even to the camp of the enemy. And so the king said, okay, go get him. You know, I don't think he wanted an interview with him. I don't think he wanted to work out something where now you're on our side. You know, this guy's messing up my plans. Go get him. So he sends an army. And they surround the city of Dothan. And his servant gets up. I close my eyes and I can see the servant. He gets up. It's early in the morning. He walks out. He's drinking his coffee. He's stretching. Dothan, as I understand it, was on a hill. And he looks around. And he goes in and he tells Elisha, hey, we're in bad trouble. The Syrians have surrounded the city. And don't you know the servant knows why they're there? This is not a war games. They're after you. And Elisha said, hey, it's okay. There's more people on our side than there are on their side. And that is the one time he has to question Elisha's sanity. Are you serious? One, two. We got two. They've got chariots and armies, and we got two. And Elisha prays that God opens his eyes, and he sees the angels and the chariots of fire. Whether they're on the hill between Elisha and the others, whether they're surrounding hills, as I understand, around Dothan, whether they're on the hills behind them, I don't know. I don't care. What I know is that His servant understood the resources of God in that moment, and that God's resources and power is first and foremost interested in what's happening spiritually. Those angels were there before Gehazi got to see them. Elisha knew they were there. I don't know if Elisha knew they were there because of some kind of divine utterance, or Elisha just understood God. And I'm not about to enter into a big discussion about guardian angels and Matthew 18 and all. You read the Bible and there are glimpses over and over and over throughout the Scriptures of a spiritual warfare that is happening on a regular basis. Read Daniel 11. Read Revelation. Look at circumstances like this and understand that God's involved in what's going on and that we are a little part of that. In fact, we are the spoil. We're the reason that war's going on. Because God wants to save His creation, His people that He made in His image. And God will take care of His folks. And you look at that and go, yeah, but well, you know, what about Job? What about Noah? Well, what about all those people in Revelation that died? What about Samson and all those people in the times of the judges that God delivered? I guarantee you, for every negative example you can come up with where God didn't deliver Stephen or God allowed James to be beheaded, I can find you someplace where God took care of his folks. Now, I don't understand why God does things the way he does. Why does he let some people die? Why does he let some people suffer? Why does he deliver other people? I don't know. That's God's purview. As Robert Turner used to say, that's whittling on God's end of the stick. But what I know is the resources of my God, the power of my God, the way that my God deals with his people who stand up and are counted. The message of Revelation is, yes, you may die, but I'm still going to take care of you. And I tell you, folks, when we can get that mindset, I will not fear what man will do to me. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5. When we can get that mindset, we can face whatever's going on out here. And maybe God's got angels surrounding us. They may not stop the physical issues that we have to deal with and the consequences, but the angels are there to rejoice in the victories of his people. And I think it's imperative that as we read through the Old Testament, we understand these lessons are here to remind us to not get caught up in all the garbage that's going on, not be afraid of what's happening, not kind of dismiss it all and just live life and enjoy it and forget what's happening around us, but to go stand up and be counted with some confidence in our God. So I want you to appreciate God's loyalty to his people. And then the last thing, and this may be the most interesting part of this. Turn back to 2 Kings chapter 6. A lot of times we kind of finish this study here. It is interesting when Elisha's servant sees the angels, and God and Elisha then prays again. God caused these Syrians to be blinded, and they are. There's an open their eyes, close their eyes, open their eyes, close their eyes. And so he tells them, and there's more going on than just blindness. He tells them, this is not the right place and I'm not the right guy. Now, do you think they really misunderstood Dothan? You know, they knew what city they were in and they knew that Elisha was there. But Elisha goes out and tells them, okay, you can't see now and I'm telling you you're in the wrong place. And if somebody blinded me, I'd be probably more inclined to think he knows what he's talking about. And so they follow him. And Elisha leads him down to the armies of the king of Israel. And the king of Israel sees him and he is salivating. Hey, can I kill him? Let me kill him. I want you to notice the contrast between, here's the man of God. And the man of God's reply to that is, don't kill him. Would you kill him if you took him captive in a war? Don't kill him, feed him and send him home. And yet the man of the earth, the man of the world, who's, hey, if I can just destroy these guys, that'll take care of this is... I'm going to tell you, that addresses my attitude head on. The guy in the pickup truck this morning, give me about 15 minutes with that guy. Let the Lord have me some time off. I guarantee you I can help his attitude. And that's the way I look at it. If God would just destroy all the wickedness, well, who's he going to save if he destroys all the wickedness? We've got a job to do. And the point is that God expects us in the midst of battle to still be godly. That's what happens with Elisha. He feed him, clothe him, take care of him. And what it does is it brings peace because he did things the way that God wanted him to do. And I want to remind you, when we are in the midst of a cultural, a spiritual battle with the world around us, God expects us to appreciate the wisdom of his demands. We're to be salt and light. We are to be meek. We are to be humble. We are to be peacemakers. We are to pursue righteousness. We are to be poor in spirit. And the temptation is to fight fire with fire. When the wicked people become more militant, well, what we need to do is we need to be more militant. No, we need to be more godly. Because militance is not going to convince those people. But godliness will, if anything will. You want to know, do you appreciate what a lot of people think about Christians in our day and age? People think Christians are hypocrites. We all come together like we're doing now. We talk peace. We talk mercy. We talk honor. We talk kindness. And then we get online and we blister everybody who doesn't agree with us. We rant and rave on Facebook. We put all kinds of terrible things about those who are immoral and those who are ungodly and those who are perverted. And people look at us and they go, you guys, you're just the conservative version of all these liberal people out here who are ungodly. You're ungodly in your godliness. And there's a lot of truth in that. When Jesus offers the Beatitudes, or in the Sermon on the Mount, when he says, you've heard that it's been said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say, love your enemy, bless those that curse you, do good to those that hate you, pray for those who despitefully use you and persecute you, that you might be the children of your Father in heaven. That's the thing to remember. It doesn't matter what people are like in the world and what we think they deserve because of their ungodliness. We are to be who we are because we are children of God. Our actions and our attitudes are to be a reflection of our faith in God. It doesn't matter if they're deserving of our kindness or not in our eyes. That's not the standard. The standard is the character of God Almighty and His Son Jesus Christ. And so in the midst of this battle that we are facing, I would remind you, we have to be kind, we have to be good, we have to be gentle, we have to be humble, we have to do good to those who wouldn't do good to us. We have to be children of our Father in heaven. It is easy in our world to feel completely overwhelmed by what's going on around us. At least, it's easy for me. I've got three daughters. Yes, I am paranoid about them. Keep your sons away from Emily. Especially you, Will. I don't think I'm the only person that reacts this way to the world around us. It's a scary world that we're living in. But I tell you, folks, there are reminders throughout the Scriptures of who God is and what God's done. And we don't have to have a miracle. He's done that for us. We just need to learn the lessons of them. And then we need to go be the people that He would have us to be, because that's the way God has always fought ungodliness in the world, by using His people. So I want to remind you as we finish, and I appreciate your attention, that those that are for us are more than those who are against us. May God bless us. Thank you so much.